Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Paul Ingalls sitting in today. Art Schreiber is our guest for this hour. Art Schreiber is well known to many New Mexicans, having lived here for over 30 years. I've known Art myself for about 20 of them, and before I introduce him a bit more to those of you who might not know Art Schreiber, let me just start by welcoming him to the KUNM Call-In Show. Welcome, Art Schreiber.
Thank you, Paul. Good morning.
It's going to be fun to visit with you this hour and have our listeners call in as well with questions. Here's the outline of Art's journey, which we'll be filling in some of the colors on as we go. Born in Canton, Ohio in 1927, Art had a voice for radio and put it to use at a radio station in East Liverpool, Ohio, to start with in the late 1940s. By the 50s and 60s, he was a reporter for Westinghouse Broadcasting, covering JFK, LBJ, MLK, reporting politics from Washington, covering the 60s battles for civil rights, presidential political conventions of that era. And perhaps most famously, Art was one of only two reporters who flew with the Beatles on almost every stop of their first major U.S. tour in 1964. Although experiencing some eyesight trouble in the late 60s, he successfully managed radio stations in Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and was named the general manager of KOB Radio here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in the early 1980s. But in 1982, Art was in Santa Fe, on August 22nd, in fact, and woke up totally blind, the result of a detached retina in his one good eye. Although multiple surgeries restored him to an extremely limited vision, it didn't stop Art. He had a talk show on KQEO in the 1990s. He ran for mayor of Albuquerque in 1993. And while not making it to the runoff, he won the endorsement of the Albuquerque Journal in the election's crowded first round, did very well in that round. And he's been an active community leader and leading advocate for the visually impaired, former president of the National Federation of the Blind, and still very much involved with that organization. And with Hal Simmons, he has written a book called Out of Sight, Blind But Doing All Right, which we'll talk about in more detail a little bit later. Now, that's the skimpiest outline I could conjure up on Art Schreiber. But Art, did I get most of that right?
You did.
Okay.
I did do commuter computer in L.A. I started ride sharing. I and Mayor Bradley and a couple of other fellows from the AAA, the American Automobile Association, and ARCO, the Atlantic Richfield Company, and we started, and it became the largest ride-sharing organization in the world.
My gosh, yeah. So let me start by saying something that I could say to very few people that I know, and that is I know exactly where you were, probably at this hour, exactly 50 years ago today. You were on a plane with John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr flying from Indianapolis to Milwaukee to see the Beatles perform for what you would have been, the fourth time out of a total of 17 times that you were going to see them perform and hang out with them.
Right.
I suppose we should just give the basic story of how is it that you ended up being on that plane and being one of two U.S. reporters flying with the Beatles on that historic tour.
Well, I was news director of a big 50,000-watt station owned by Westinghouse in Cleveland, KYW. Today, those call letters are in Philadelphia, but then they were in Cleveland. And I came back from lunch one day, stopped in the program director's office. All the disc jockeys were sitting around, and the music director, the program production manager, and it was like a wake. No one was saying anything. I said, "What happened?" And someone said, "HK got the Beatles." That meant our number one competitor, WHK, paid $25,000 to bring the Beatles to Cleveland.
To be able to promote the concert.
Uh-huh. And I don't know whatever possessed me, but I looked at the program director and said, "Why don't you put me on the Beatles tour?" And that's how it all happened.
Huh. And there were only two of you that traveled, you and Larry Kane of Philadelphia.
Larry Kane, mm-hmm. Who you have talked to, and three British reporters. Ivor Davis, who has just written a book about the Beatles tour himself, I'm quoted quite extensively in it, as did Larry Kane, who quoted me extensively in his book Ticket to Ride. But another correspondent of the Liverpool Gazette, which was the Beatles' hometown newspaper, his name was, of all things, George Harrison.
Wow. Yeah.
Had no relation to the Beatles.
Now, there's a story about that we'll get to in a little bit, too. Now, this means that you were sitting on the plane with the Beatles. You were interviewing them almost every day to create short reports that went out on the Westinghouse Broadcasting Network. And we're going to play some of the few interviews of yours that survived that tour. Luckily, some did, many did not.
Right.
Most people know that I've done a number of documentaries on the Beatles, and I have to say, this is one of the most charming pieces of tape that I've ever heard from John Lennon that we're going to start with to sort of establish the repartee and the camaraderie that Art and John Lennon established in their time together 50 years ago. This was recorded 50 years ago yesterday, actually, Art Schreiber talking to John Lennon.
John, what were they throwing up on a stage in Philadelphia last night?
Everything bar the limbs, I think.
I know jelly beans were thrown. Anything else?
Jelly beans, yeah. There was a sort of carton of milk, or half-empty carton of milk, a bit of cake I had stood in. It's not much fun, you know.
How about all the cakes that you get? Do you like cake?
We're not all that keen on it. We're going off it gradually. There's mania for cakes, only to the thought, you see.
You were saying the Americans must have a great yen for cakes, don't they?
Well, either that or they're very good cooks. They like making cakes, you know.
Maybe they could toss these streamers or something, you know, papers. That
streamers, great. Yeah. Balloons, things like that. You know, so all, nobody gets hurt, but jelly beans and bits of cake, because they must know we can't eat them once we've trodden on them. And they do. The American jelly beans are hard. In England, it was bad.
Phone!
You know, but they're only soft jelly beans over there, and it was rough then. But over here, they're made out of rock.
Have you been hit with any? I mean, actually, you know, hit in the head.
Yeah, last night I got hit with two. And it's hard to sort of sing if you're smiling. And one just got me on the temple. Another one got me on the chest. And one got George on the guitar hand. He had to stop playing, you know. It sounded like complaining, but we like the idea. If they have to sell us them, even though we don't like them, send us them. I mean, send them, you know, like people send letters or parcels rather than throw them. Please, please, that's all I say. No jelly beans and bits of cake and things and combs. We've got combs.
We've got combs. It's Art Schreiber with John Lennon, September 3rd, 1964. I'd like to have you talk about sitting with John Lennon when you didn't have a microphone on.
We sat together on the plane all the time. And, of course, we played Monopoly with George night after night after night. But John didn't want to talk about music. And it was just
jelly beans.
Because I didn't know anything about music and don't today. But he was very involved with what was happening politically and socially in America. And he couldn't understand why we were having such difficulty with civil rights. President Kennedy, who he had met, had been killed. When he found out that I had traveled with Kennedy and traveled Martin Luther King all through the South, by that time, and before that was 63, I was with King a lot in the South. He wanted to talk about what was going on in America.
Now, even just 5 years later, you couldn't have put a microphone in front of John Lennon without him advocating for peace or questioning the war in Vietnam. But in 1964, I guess it would never even occur to any reporter or musician to record a conversation about current events.
That's right. And I had recorded so much. And, of course, all my tapes were stolen when I got home. But I did have an awful lot of tapes with John talking about what his vision of the world was.
Really?
Would have been.
So you did tape in some conversations about current events with
him? Yes.
But they just didn't survive?
No.
Yeah. That's unfortunate. This is the KUNM call-in show. Paul Ingles sitting in. Art Schreiber is our guest for the hour, and we're talking about Art's storied career, which includes time spent with the Beatles exactly 50 years ago this week. If you'd like to ask a question of John, we certainly welcome your input. The number's here, 277-5866. Did I just say John? Ask a question
of John.
Yes,
you did. We'd have a hard time asking a question, John.
That was a very hopeful statement, actually, in more ways than one. 277-5866, if you'd like to talk with Art Schreiber, 277-5866, or toll-free, 877-899-5866. And let me just finish talking with you a little bit more about the Beatles. It's not all we're going to talk about, but here's another clip I'd like to play. I think you told me this conversation with Paul McCartney was probably in Kansas City, September 17th, the night after wasn't there a nearly riotous night in New Orleans at City Park Stadium?
Yes.
Okay, so let's play it and then talk about it. Art Schreiber with Paul McCartney in 1964.
Paul, are you going to get a chance to wave? I understand the rumor, at least. I was down among the crowd, and they
I saw you.
Did you?
I saw you, yeah, from the window.
Well,
I saw the police moving you on, too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They're moving everybody on down there.
I thought so, yeah.
Are you going to get to wave to them?
Well, I was waving before, actually. The police told us not to, but I thought, be a bit sneaky, you know. A little bit of a sneaky trick, and we'll wave.
Give them a break.
Well, you know, I mean, I'd feel daft if I was down there in the crowd and nobody was waving. Actually, there's been somebody waving from one of the top windows anyway, not one of us. But,
you know. Were you concerned at all last night when they started to storm the stage?
No. Because, you know, it looks more frightening than it actually is. Because, I mean, did you see the amount of police that came out? It was like a little army, you know. Well, you can't be worried when you know all that amount of cops are there, you know, to look after you.
Now, the intensity of these crowds is pretty hard to make people appreciate these days. And although the Beatles were usually protected from these mobs, usually, but not always, the reporters weren't. There were many scary moments for you personally, weren't there?
Sure were. And it wasn't that the kids were wanting to hurt anybody, but it was just they were so emotional and wanted to grab and claw at the first person that had anything to do with the Beatles. And, you know, they would just grab you and with those fingernails that many of the young girls had in those days, they didn't do very well with clothing. And I lost 3 suits on the tour, as well as a couple of typewriters and several tape recorders.
You told me about riding somewhere with Ringo toward a hotel, and you both got caught by a mob on a hotel loading deck.
Well, I told the cab that it wasn't a cab. It was the state police picked us up at the charter plane. There was a car that would take the Beatles, one that took then Derek Taylor, their press agent, and his assistant and the stage manager, and then the one with us, the newsmen, and 2 photographers. There were 5 newsmen, 3 British, 2 American. But this one, all the Beatles got mixed up, and Ringo happened to get into our car, and I was sitting in the front seat. He was, too, and bunch seats in those days, no bucket seats. I told the policeman, I said, when we came to the hotel, I said, and of course it was just thousands of people around this motel trying to get in, and I said, don't stop at all, keep going. He said, I'm going around to the loading dock, and I said, good. Well, we got to the loading dock, but of course many kids followed. Ringo was not very tall. I, standing up, I'm 6 feet, and the loading dock was at my chin. Well, poor Ringo was much lower than that, and by this time, some girls had grabbed him and had a chokehold on him, and they finally got him up onto the loading dock, and he was really gasping for breath. it was a scary moment for him and for several of us.
Let me play one bit of tape from another scary moment. It wasn't recording when during this particular event, but it gives you some idea of the intensity of the kids closing in around you in this case, in this clip here.
Don't watch the street. Don't.
What do you got that in your hand for? What do you got that in your hand for?
Are you staying with the Beatles?
Yeah!
Please, don't.
Come on.
I don't.
Why?
This is a recorder.
Why? What we're saying?
Yeah, you're being recorded.
Hi!
We want Ringo!
Ringo!
We want
Well, they had me down on the ground along with the cab driver and the British correspondent, George Harrison, not the Beatle. And we had just gotten out of the cab, and so they got us all on the ground, and they had grabbed George Harrison's suitcase out of the trunk of the car, and, of course, it flew open, and all his clothing went everywhere. I say to this day there is someone who has a pair of underwear that they swear is George Harrison's. Well, it is, but it's not the Beatle.
Yeah, look for it on eBay soon, but be a cautious purchaser. Art Schreiber is our guest on the KUNM call-in show. We're going to take a quick break and then come back with a phone call or two, and you're welcome to call in as well. They're welcome at 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. It's toll-free anywhere in the state, 877-899-5866. A teeny bit more about the Beatles after the break, and then we're also going to talk about Art covering Washington politics in the mid-1960s, meeting JFK and LBJ and Martin Luther King Jr., other historic figures and moments, all when the KUNM call-in show returns right after this break.
This Week in This American Life.
You got to tighten up your story.
Our longtime producer Alex Bloomberg is trying to start his own business, and he is recording the entire awkward process, like when a billionaire investor who he's pitching gives up any pretense that he might invest and just starts coaching him.
We'll start again. You're uniquely positioned to do it because you're better at it than anybody?
Yeah, I am.
I apologize for that.
Yeah. This Week.
Sunday afternoons at 4 on KUNM.
Put a gun to his chest and pulled the trigger.
That sounds like murder.
The controversy over the police shootings of civilians in Albuquerque continues to rage. This week on New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas, Stephen Spitz hosts an exclusive interview with Professor David Correa, a leader in the protests against APD's killings of civilians. We'll learn about how we got to this point, the specifics of the proposed consent decree with the DOJ, and find out what protections a federal police monitor will provide. All this and more this Friday morning at 8 on 89.9 KUNM.
This is the KUNM call-in show each Thursday morning, 8 to 9 on KUNM. I'm Paul Engels, honored to be sitting in this week with veteran broadcaster Art Schreiber in the studio with us. Art reported on the biggest stories of the 1960s. He managed radio stations in the 70s and 80s, lost his sight in 1982, and went on to another 30 years of productivity and community service. This year at 86, he's published a book called Out of Sight, Blind, and Doing All Right, about facing his challenge of losing his sight, which we'll talk a little bit more about later in the program. We do have a caller online, though. We want to get to Jim in Las Vegas. We've been talking about Art's time with the Beatles on tour in 1964. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Well, hi. And Art, it's Jim Turr in Las Vegas, and I'm so glad to hear your voice and hear that you've got a book. And I did not know you spent so much time with the Beatles, and I'm proud that it was you that represented New Mexico and the U.S., for that matter, with them and got to spend so much time with them. I have a question. I have two questions. Number one, what happened to the tapes that you mentioned? Were they stolen? Do you think they were they stolen for any political reason or just stolen in general? And what do they look like that we might keep an eye out for them in case they're still floating around Albuquerque?
That's a great question, Jim. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. They were very small tapes made on a Grundig tape recorder. That's what we used in those days. It was one of the smaller tape recorders, and Nothing was very small in 1964, unfortunately, but they were very small reels of tape. I guess, what did you call those, Paul? 2-3-inch reels, mm-hmm. I think we called them.
Yeah.
And they were stolen from my office at KYW in Cleveland when I was doing a documentary on the tour. I believe it was an inside job. I always suspected that it might have been the assistant program director, but there was no proof of that. But anyway, a gentleman from Albuquerque who later moved east had met me at a fundraiser, and he called me from the east, and he said, "Art, I have found some of your tapes on the internet, and all the only tapes I have to this day, and the ones that Paul has played here today, and the others that I have, were recovered from the internet. So none of my tapes were stolen, I don't think, for any political reasons. I think someone just wanted to have all that memorabilia."
And you would have to have maintained specialized equipment over the years to be able to even play them back. So it's kind of a miracle that we have any to listen to. I want to move on to so many other areas, but I'm going to end with one Beatles punctuation point here, just so Ringo and George fans don't feel cheated. Let's hear a clip from interviews that you did with each of them. Ringo first talking with you about American disc jockeys, and George being plainly honest with reporters about what the band was actually there in the U.S. to do.
Do they have, how about the British disc jockeys compared to American disc jockeys? They talk as fast?
Well, they're like a horse race, and our disc jockeys always come in last. Cause they're a lot slower, you know, than the American disc jockeys. And they, you know, they sort of talk, and, you know, and then, but the Americans, "Oh, hey, I'm going now, I'm going to play a little record now. Here we go, baby, whoop!" And it's on, you know, but ours is sort of saying, "We'd like to play a little number for you now. It's a new record by the Swindle Soodles, and it's called, I Hope You Like It. Here we go."
Yeah, but we didn't come here intending to sightsee.
What did you intend to do?
To do about 30 shows and make some money.
Did you make any money, you think?
A bit. Not very much.
I understand they have a fresh cargo plane out there to carry it all home.
Untrue.
George, good luck to you.
Thanks,
Art. Been on the tour.
See you again.
Okay.
Art Schreiber with George Harrison and Ringo Starr there. These are clips that you can hear longer versions of, and I believe that we're going to be able to post some of them on the KUNM website. The entire documentary that I did with Art and other people is also available at prx.org, the Public Radio Exchange, and you can hear that for free there if you like. Art Schreiber is our guest. Before all this happened with the Beatles, Art was an honest-to-goodness eyewitness to big history. And I want to talk with him a little bit about that, too, but we've got some other callers lining up. So let's get to Johnny in Santa Fe. Johnny, you're on the air with Art Schreiber.
Arthur, it's
yes.
Johnny Gillespie.
Hello, Johnny.
How are you, my dear?
I'm fine, thank you.
Okay, I have a question for you that you and I never talked about, which was, when you were traveling with the Beatles as much as you did and doing your all-nighters and playing Monopoly, did you find yourself ever taking on their accent, their hairstyle, their clothing styles, any habits that they had? I would love to know how you changed with that.
Well, there are folks that would tell you, Johnny, that Art Schreiber did dress similarly to a Beatle, even though I was so much older than they. But when I got to Los Angeles, I did let my hair grow, and there are some photos that, unfortunately, my hair wasn't as nice as the Beatles, and so I never could get a good hairdo like that. But, yeah, I never got the accent. Yes, I did try to acquire, not try, but I did acquire an accent because I did so much traveling to London and England, because I established a bureau there for Westinghouse, and I spent an awful lot of time in Great Britain.
I thought it was sort of interesting that your first radio job was in East Liverpool, Ohio.
That's right. And named kind of, I guess, after the Beatles' Liverpool.
Uh-huh. Well, I was just about to say...
By the way, Johnny was used to be a neighbor. She designed my apartments. She was a fabulous designer, and I wish I had her today because she is one of the best, and now she's a very successful realtor.
You're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Paul Engel, sitting in this week with veteran broadcaster Art Schreiber. Art, I was in New York in June and managed to get in to see one of the shows in the last week of Bryan Cranston's brilliant portrayal of LBJ.
I'd love to see it.
It's called All the Way. It's the story of 1963, 64, 65 primarily, and there was Johnson, of course, and Hubert Humphrey, Senator Richard Russell from Georgia, J. Edgar Hoover, Everett Dirksen, Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael. You knew all of these men and covered this incredible period of history. I asked you once about comparing today's political stalemate in Washington with how legislation happened in the 50s and 60s. Talk about LBJ and Dirksen in the Senate and how the leading Democrats and leading Republicans worked back in those days.
Well, Dirksen told me a wonderful story about, I asked him one time why Lyndon was having so much trouble with the Vietnam War when he was president. And Dirksen said, well, I'll tell you. And he had that great voice. But he said, you know, when Lyndon was a majority leader and I was the minority leader, now this is Everett Dirksen talking.
Do it in his voice. I love him.
Great senator from Illinois. And he talked like this. And he said, Lyndon would call me up and he'd say, Ev, I got a problem and I'm coming down. Now, as Everett Dirksen said, he was the majority leader. He could have summoned me, Everett Dirksen, the minority leader, to his office. But no, he came down. And he said, pretty soon I'd hear a knock on the door. But before he heard that knock on the door, he rolled open a big double-decker drawer of his huge desk and pulled out a bottle of bourbon, set it on the desk, and two glasses. And he said, I'd hear a knock come back there at the door. And Everett had a huge office as he was still minority leader. And he said, I'd say, come in. And Ev would spot the bottle and get LBJ spot the bottle and get a big smile on his face. And he'd walk up and he'd say, Ev, when the bottle's empty, we're going to have a deal. Now, it wasn't that insinuating they were big drinkers. They loved their whiskey. But the point is that they worked together. They were friends. They were political enemies. They fought on the floor of the Senate. But when the day was over, they had a drink together. They were friends. And there were so many people like that. Hubert Humphrey was like that with many, many Republicans. There were even Goldwater. At one time, Goldwater could make friends, and he did, with the opposite aisle. But today that isn't the case. And they're so polarized now. But it wasn't that way when I covered the Hill.
Mm-hmm. You know, you told me once that the reputation of politics in New Mexico was somewhat legendary in D.C. long before you found yourself out to this part of the world. How did Senator Russell put it, you told me once?
Well, I knew Senator Russell pretty well. And he said to me one time, he said, young man, he said, if you weren't educated in politics, you get your B.A. in Trenton, you get your master's in Baton Rouge, but you get your Ph.D. in Santa Fe. I didn't know what he was talking about because I had never been to New Mexico. As much as Jack Kennedy used to tell me I had to visit the state because Jack had fallen in love with the state. But I didn't know until I got here what Richard Russell really meant.
Did it turn out to be true?
Yes, it did.
Art Schreiber is here. Art ran for mayor in 1993, did very well in the primary. We've got a question from Jeff about mayoral politics. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the KUNM call-in show.
Thanks. I wanted to just make one observation first, which was that I was recently down in Las Cruces and noticed a proclamation celebrating the Beatles signed by Governor King in his first administration, and I wondered how big of a fan he could have been and whether his sons, Bill and Gary, might have had something to do with that proclamation, but maybe a reporter today would have to ask.
Know anything about that, Art?
I didn't know that. And, of course, you know, when I traveled with the Beatles, now this is 1964, I had never dreamed that I would someday ever be in New Mexico. Hubert Humphrey used to kid me. He would say, Schreiber, you got to visit my state. We got 10,000 lakes. And I never got to Minnesota. Covering all the politics that I did, there were two states that I never got to, Minnesota and New Mexico, until I ended up managing KSTP for Hubbard Broadcasting. And when one day Muriel Humphrey came to my office, and I knew Muriel and her husband very well, and I said, Muriel, I wish Hubert were here because finally I got to his state. And I never dreamed that I would ever be stationed in New Mexico until Stan Hubbard one time called me. I was visiting my kids. I was managing in Minnesota. Had been terrible winter, two winters that I had survived up there. And he called me. He said, Schreiber, I know you don't like the weather. I know you like the sunshine. I want you to go to New Mexico and manage KOB. I said, Stan, stop. I'm on my way. And I was here in 2 days after that call.
Before we start talking about some maybe local politics and also your book, Out of Sight, Blind and Doing All Right, what were your impressions of Martin Luther King Jr.? What's something maybe less well known about his story that you might have witnessed in your reporting?
He was the greatest public speaker I ever covered and ever knew, for that matter. It was incredible how he could judge an audience. I have been with him when he talked to as few as 25 people in a country church in Mississippi. Also been with him in country churches in Alabama and Georgia. And yet I was with him at the great, you know, I Have a Dream speech, where he spoke to 250,000. But he had the wonderful ability to judge an audience, and he measured what he said by that, and he could get 25 people as enthused as he got 250,000. He was just a brilliant man, and he had very few notes when he spoke. It was just a brilliant mind that I was always amazed, and yet had a wonderful sense of humor. I have sat with him in a motel throughout the South until wee hours of the morning talking about, yes, what was happening in civil rights, but talking about politics, he was not a sports person, and I loved sports in those days, and still do. But he just had an ability to communicate, whether one-on-one or with a group of people. An amazing human being.
Is Jeff still on the line? Did we want to get one more question from Jeff? Because I didn't want to cut you off.
I'm sorry, Jeff.
That's okay. Jeff, we've got a break. We've got a break.
I was just observing, though, that you've been in New Mexico for a similar time that there have been mayors of Albuquerque, and the position you ran for, and you've known probably all of them, and I'm just curious what your thoughts were on the different mayors of Albuquerque over time.
Okay, Jeff, thanks for the question.
Thank you, Jeff. I have known them all, and we don't have the time for me to list my opinions of all the mayors of Albuquerque. But someday, Jeff, I'll be glad if you see me somewhere and we can talk. I'll tell you my ideas of all the mayors that I have known in the city of Albuquerque.
Boy, that was a politically diplomatic answer if I ever heard one. But we are getting close to running out of time here. It's 8:39. We're going to take a quick break and be back more with Art Schreiber on the KUNM Call-In Show right after this short break.
A sumptuous feast of New Mexico-grown products is served at the Rio Grande Agricultural Land Trust Annual Harvest Dinner. The feast is at Farm and Table in Albuquerque's North Valley, Sunday, September 14th, 5 p.m. to starlight. Enjoy live and silent auctions. All proceeds dedicated to preserving agriculture, wildlife habitat, open space, and New Mexico's scenic vistas. Tickets at rgalt.org or call 884-6557. A message from the tax-exempt Rio Grande Agricultural Land Trust.
Support for KUNM programming comes in part from our contributing listeners and by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Paul Ingalls, sitting in this week. Happy to be visiting with veteran broadcaster and community leader Art Schreiber. Art, who went blind in 1982, has written a recent book, Out of Sight, Blind and Doing All Right. He's been telling us about covering all kinds of news in the 1950s and 60s, including riding along the tour plane with the Beatles. And I have confirmed that KUNM is going to put links up to some of the longer versions of the interviews we heard earlier. You can find it at KUNM.org. And as we noted earlier, he ran a competitive campaign for mayor in 1993. I've always thought of Art as a very well-connected observer of New Mexico politics. Let me just ask you for quick takes on some current topics. Art, you game for that?
Sure.
Okay. So the Albuquerque Police Department and the Justice Department, conclusion of undue use of force, the citizen protests. What thoughts have come to mind as you've watched this unfold? You ran for mayor. If you were in Mayor Richard Berry's shoes, what would you be doing, do you think, to address that, settle things down?
Well, I'd fire the police chief and get someone who, in my opinion, is qualified. That's the first thing. But I really believe that what the government has done, I'm talking about the federal government, in giving all this equipment to police departments has hurt every police department in America. It certainly has hurt us. Police are today, think they're, you know, they're war veterans, and instead of being police. Personal policing is a skill, and it needs to be taught. We need to get the right people qualified for that work, and we need to talk about race relations. We need to talk about race. We can't just hide it. And we need to talk about people who are living in poverty and the homeless. This is all part of police. I know they have a very difficult job, but we can't continue what we're doing. And it starts at the top. And I don't think the mayor has confronted what he's got to do, and they've got to get it done. And I don't know, it just seems to me they're stalling, and I believe that's because he's got a police chief that, in my opinion, is not qualified.
All right, Susana Martinez versus Gary King for governor. What do you expect in November?
Well, money is where it's at in politics today. It's sad, but it's true. She's got a war chest that can't be matched. And money is where it's at. And unfortunately, I don't think Gary's a very good campaigner, never has been. Good man, but doesn't do well campaigning. Susanna wants to be vice president, and, maybe she'll make it someday.
Now, it appears that New Mexico has lost the four-state bid for the Tesla car battery factory, about 6,500 jobs maybe. The Santa Fe, New Mexico, already reporting today that the Democratic reaction is blaming Governor Martinez. Is that critique merited, perhaps, or do you know?
No, I don't think so, because I just don't think we're there. I think we are too far, the same as Texas, as much as Texas could have given them. They're headquartered in California. I think they needed to be close, and Las Vegas, Nevada, they're not in Las Vegas, Reno, but they have no, you know, their tax laws are much more favorable, and so I'm not surprised that it's Nevada.
All right, we have another caller online. This is Clifton, been holding for a bit from Albuquerque. Clifton, thanks for your patience. You're on the air now with Art Schreiber.
Well, I'm privileged. Just had one quick question. I'd like to ask Mr. Schreiber what his impression of the, 10 years on, what the radio deregulation has done for the media.
Oh, that's a great question.
Well, it's tragic. It started with Ronald Reagan and has continued under Democratic and Republican administrations. Unfortunately, Reagan started it. I happen to believe that it started with the Fairness Doctrine being disbanded.
This was the doctrine that required commercial stations to give equal time.
Yes.
To points of view in the community.
Yeah, of public items, issues of public importance, and when we lost that. And then when they allowed companies to, used to be you could own 7 a.m. and 5 f.m. stations, and we had a great industry. But when that started expanding, and now you've got two companies that own most of the radio stations in America, Clear Channel and Cumulus. They said, oh, it'll give us diversity. It hasn't given any diversity. They run all the programming out of Austin, Texas, or someplace else, and every station sounds the same. You drive across the country, and all rock stations sound the same. All country stations sound the same. And they've done it to get rid of people, to make money, but not to serve the public. And the public is not being served by commercial radio today, my friends.
When I came out of college in 1978, there were more jobs in radio for news reporters because every local station had to maintain a news department, and most of them did, anywhere from 3 to 9 or more people. And, of course, you ran all news stations where, you had dozens of people working news. That's one of the things that went away with deregulation, because they also said that no longer do radio stations need to maintain news departments or even do any news. So a lot of people don't recognize that that's also what disappeared, I think, in the 1980s.
Folks, when we and I was in the business, we had to apply for our license renewal with the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. Westinghouse used to file probably about a 7-pound document. It was huge, and it was accurate, and it would told how much news we did, how much public service, and all the things we had to search in the community for issues of public importance. And today, your license renewal is a postcard. What is that? The airwaves, folks, in my opinion, are owned by the public. They're not owned by corporations or private individuals.
We have about 10 minutes left. Art Schreiber is our guest. I want to get one more phone call in before I ask Art a little bit about his book. This is Brian holding from California. Go ahead, Brian. You're on the KUNM call-in show.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiber. It's Brian Quintana. Good
hey,
to hear from
Brian.
You.
Hi. Great to
Hi.
Hear from you.
Good to have you on the show today. And I had a question I think I've asked you before, but what has been the most notable interview you have done and why?
Oh, boy, Brian, I think probably Jack Kennedy, because I just had fun with him talking about sports. He found out that I was a statistician for the Cleveland Browns at the time I was traveling with him, and we used to really love to talk about sports and football and so forth. I still say I've had wonderful interviews with the people I've mentioned, Martin Luther King, Hubert Humphrey, Everett Dirksen, Goldwater, as well as LBJ. But I have to give it to JFK.
Thanks for the question.
Thanks, Brian, and good luck to you. Brian is a blind man that grew up here in New Mexico and is working, I believe, for AmeriCorps.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about your book that came out this spring, Out of Sight, Blind and Doing All Right. Obviously, with all the stories you've been telling us today, you chose to write your memoir mostly about your experience of dealing with your loss of sight. Who did you want to write the book mostly for?
For people who are losing their sight or who are blind, and because I've worked with so many people, Paul, that are losing sight, and so many people believe that it's the end of the world, that they give up, and it isn't. If we are willing to accept our blindness, I liken blindness to alcoholism or drug abuse. And I know I'm criticized by many blind people for this, but I believe that you must accept your blindness the same as if you want to overcome alcoholism or drug abuse. You've got to accept the fact you're an addict and then say, I'm going to do something about it. And blindness is no different in this respect. You need to learn alternative techniques. You need to learn to use the white cane. You need to accept your blindness, and so many people, just the word blind, people don't want to say they're blind. They were visually impaired. Well, as Dr. Jernigan, a former president of the National Federation of the Blind, used to hold up two or three fingers in front of somebody who was saying, oh, I'm not blind, and he'd say, how many fingers have I got? And they couldn't tell him, and he'd say, you're blind. And it just comes to that we need to accept it. And I wanted people to know about what I went through. No, I'm not a hero. I just, though, made up my mind that I had to do something. I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought life was over. And fortunately, I got with the National Federation of the Blind. And I tell this story by a man by the name of David Tiki, who at the time worked for Xerox Corporation, which manufactured the Kurzweil reading machine. Now, I was told to get this reading machine. I didn't know it was the size of a small washing machine and cost $30,000. I call this guy, and he's with Xerox, and I said, I want this reading machine. And I'm telling him, and he said, how long you been blind? And I said, 3 months. He said, my friend, you better learn to function as a blind man before you get a reading machine. And that's what I want to get across to people. Yes, we have wonderful technology today. We call it assistive technology, and we can use it. But you first need to learn the skills of blindness, and that is the use of the white cane, alternative techniques. I don't do things just the way you do them or the way sighted people do them, but I can do them. Now I can't be a surgeon or an airline pilot, I guess. Maybe we're coming close, though. And, you know, we just the National Federation of the Blind proved a year or so ago at the Daytona Speedway with the president now of the Federation of the Blind, Mark Riccobono. He drove a car, totally blind, drove a car. The truck was in front of him and throwing stuff and down on the speedway, and he was avoiding all of it. And we can do that. The technology is available today. to do that. But the point is, I'm not talking about driving a car. I'm talking about functioning as a blind person, and we can do it. And I wrote the book hoping that people who read it will come to grips with their blindness, their loss of sight, and do something about it. You've got to get training.
As a sighted person, I can tell you that reading the book also, I think, is very valuable to those who have not had a visual challenge. And of course, you never know. I mean, I'm 58. There's a history of macular degeneration in my family. You know, I don't know what's ahead for me. But I think it also is a useful book for people who, you know, can help everybody recognize the challenges of the visually handicapped or the blind. I want you to retell a story that I thought was especially moving in here. It wasn't too long. Well, I'm not exactly sure exactly what year it was, but it's the one when you're telling the story of walking back to your condo in downtown Albuquerque on a fall day.
Ah, yes.
When you...
I had just come out of the fitness center where I used to go when I lived downtown, and I was walking down Copper. I got 5th Street, and I was crossing the street at 5th Street on Copper, and of course St. Mary's Church is right there, and it's always a lot of trees and a lot of grass. Well, there were leaves were all over, and I don't know, suddenly a big just something, depression, grabbed me, and I said, you know, it's fall, I can't see the colors, and I became very depressed. And, you know, I don't know what possessed me, but I threw my gym bag down. I walked over into the grass, but it was covered by a foot of leaves. And I dumped my gym bag down, tossed my white cane down, and I got down in the leaves, and I was rolling in the leaves, and I have wondered to this day if someone saw me and said, what in the world is wrong with him? But I started rolling in leaves, and I said to myself, you know, I can't see, but I can smell, and I can smell fall. And I got up, and I grabbed my cane and my gym bag, and I made it back to the condo, and I don't know what happened, Paul, but that was a feeling that I had that I said, hey, you know, you can just do it a different way.
Mm-hmm. There's still a lot out there. Well, you've been getting the most out of it for 30 years since the blindness, and of course, we've really enjoyed having your stories here today. The book is called Out of Sight, Blind and Doing All Right by Art Schreiber, as told to Hal Simmons. Art has a couple of book signings coming up, Bookworks and Page One. I think you told me on the way in that you're going to be posting all of these dates on your own website. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
ArtSchreiber.com, and those dates will be up there before too long if you want to catch Art. And then he's going on a tour of the Denver and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Columbus to be telling his stories about the Beatles, too. So you've got a busy fall ahead, don't you?
I sure do.
You won't have much time to roll around in the leaves, I'm afraid.
But the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Paul, I'm really looking forward to it. They have invited me. I'm going to present my scrapbook on the Beatles to the Rock Hall of Fame in Cleveland, and I get to present my Beatles presentation on the big stage at The Rock on October 1st, 7 o'clock in the evening.
Oh, that's going to be so exciting. Congratulations, Art. The theme music means we're running out of time. You can hear this show again and others in the KUNM Call-In Show series on the KUNM website, kunm.org. Our engineer today has been Jefferson White. Phone screener Michael Hess. Assistant producer is Kaveh Mavahid. And executive producer of the KUNM Call-In Show is KUNM News Director Elaine Baumgartel. I'm certainly glad you joined us today. Thanks to Art Schreiber. Stay well, won't you? Stay well, Art.
I sure will, and thank you, Paul. And best of luck to KUNM.
All right, I appreciate that. I'm Paul Ingalls. Kathleen Sable will be back next week on the KUNM Call-In Show. Have yourselves a great day.